This is EBBF Ethical Business Building the Future, a Baha'i-inspired global learning community discovering how your values can contribute to a more prosperous, just, and sustainable civilization.
I'm just so pleased to be here with the EBBF crew and just to meet some of you for the first time and to see some of you again.
Very exciting to have you here, Emily, today. So just a brief introduction for the one that do not know you, and feel free to add anything. So you're born in Melbourne, Australia, and currently you are based in New York, where you are a sustainable investment professional, executive vice president and chief responsible investment officer at Calvert Research and Management. But you have a very international experience. You have studied in Oxford as a lawyer in Baker and McKinsey. You have also worked in various legal and human rights coordinating and authored Australia's NGO report to the UN Women's Rights Commission. So it's a very exciting background you're bringing into the table today. And I would love to open up the room.
For me, I know that my concept of what's meaningful, at least to me when it comes to work, has changed over 35 years. How's your idea, concept of what's meaningful to you when it comes to, you know, the work you do, changed over time?
Thanks, Mark. That's a really wonderful question. I think that is a really important question, because obviously what we think is a meaningful career is tied to what we think is a meaningful life. And as you go through life, your experiences shift and shift what you think a meaningful life looks like. So certainly I would think about this in terms of time for myself. So when I was younger, I was very focused on social justice and human rights issues. I was very interested in justice issues. As growing up during apartheid era, you know, South Africa, and seeing that change very dramatically when I was very young and impressionable, and then seeing the fall of the Berlin Wall, and just growing up very aware of different social movements and injustices that existed in the world, and feeling motivated, and I think having the encouragement of my parents to focus on that as a ethos for how I would contribute to the world in some way. And for me, that meant in the younger years, human rights and social justice NGOs. And so when I went through my university and was trying to set up for, you know, how am I going to make a contribution to these areas that I felt passionately about, I was very focused on getting into the law field, doing a law degree, and then finding a pathway into something to do with law and human rights. And then it shifted into international development as I was going through my university studies. And I tried to pursue that. I did like a ton of different internships and experiences with different NGOs. I worked in disadvantaged kind of public interest law and disadvantaged legal services for disadvantaged or marginalized groups, including the Tahereh Justice Center in the US, and then the Homeless Persons Legal Clinic in Melbourne, which was a real kind of advance for its time in terms of legal services for that population. And all of my role models in the law advise that if you really want to be an excellent lawyer and defend the rights of marginalized people, you really need to go to a corporate law firm and get your training there. And I followed that advice, took it to heart and diligently followed that advice and did everything I could to position as someone who was going to be acceptable to a corporate law firm and kind of get into that whole world. And I thought, well, even though this might be, I'm ultimately inspired by this broader vision of social change, actually, I'm interested in power generally. And I think understanding power and the exertion of power through being in the legal field would be very useful and informative. And I was very open to eventually becoming a law firm partner and kind of having an influence that way. And then over the course of being in the law firm, realized that law is actually quite a specific skill. And there are some people who are very talented at it. And I wasn't necessarily going to be the most talented lawyer, although I could do it. And I think it really opened up a lot of questions for me around contrasting the private legal practice from my NGO experiences. I felt a real tension between, on the one side, in the NGO human rights field, a lot of constraint around resources. So a huge vision of impact and change in these organizations, but always a constraint on resources that would dictate how the projects, which projects would get picked up and how long they would run for, generally only a year. And there'd be all this reporting to donors. And I saw over the years how kind of what was in vogue with donors would massively shift how funding was allocated to different issues around the world. One year it was Timor, East Timor. The next year it was Banda Aceh. Like, this money would just move around, and it seemed like a very unsustainable way of fostering social change. On the other hand, in the private law firm, tons of resources, like incredible amounts of money going into investment funds that we were establishing and listings and sale of assets, but not a vision of how any of it interconnected with a broader environmental social vision of progress for humanity. And so I started to become interested in creating meaning in my career in the private sector, where you could marry together the commitment to social and environmental change, progress, unity, in whatever way you want to phrase that, and the scale and power of the private sector. And I started to think about that, you know, around, you know, the late 2000s as I was finishing up my legal career. And then from there, I suppose I became a much more nuanced mark in my feeling about what I thought a meaningful career could look like. And I really opened myself up to the private sector in a way when I was much younger. I was very hard line about it, very black and white. And if you'd ever told me that, well, Emily, you'll end up working for this division of a really large kind of global Wall Street bank, which is Morgan Stanley. So Morgan Stanley is the parent company for Calvert Research and Management. I would have like laughed in your face and said, no way, I'm not joining Wall Street. But the reality is that maybe it's the time in which I've been born, I've been able to grow at a time when I think the fundamental assumptions around what's right and wrong, what's kind of positive and negative, is becoming a lot more nuanced as the world becomes a lot more global, as communities become more diverse, as systemic issues, the kind of crisis that we're in around different systemic issues becomes a lot more apparent. I think it's clear now that every institution and every kind of every sphere of human endeavor has a role to play in addressing the human crises that we face today.
I mean, your definition of meaningful career has changed, right? As you said at the beginning, according to your definition of meaningful life. And I give for granted that your definition of success has changed throughout your career, how it has changed. And if you can have this type of conversation in your industry as well, about definition of success with your clients, with your team, and if you can inspire them.
I mean, I think the definition of career success is, you know, it's not only, achieving seniority or achieving impact and influence. I think it's also, are you living a life that you are happy with, right? And obviously the work that you're doing is an integrated part of that. And we spend so much time working in our lives that I think it's important that whatever you do and the people you're doing it with, you feel like they're your friends and you feel like the content of what you do is intellectually engaging and interesting to you. And the actual activities that you're doing are inherently satisfying to you in some way because you're going to be spending a lot of time doing it, like whatever it is. And so you don't want it to feel like, well, you know, that career success is somehow in opposition to my kind of life success, I suppose. But then I think as I've grown professionally, I think my definition of career success, I think that we can be a little bit too atomized or individualistic also in the way we think about career success, that it's somehow about a title or it's about me and my individual, you know, accolades or whatever. I'm increasingly have an aversion to all of that. I mean, even doing this webinar, I feel a bit like, you know, oh, like in the center of attention, but actually everything that I think I've ever achieved, if I've achieved anything, has been as a result of working in a team with other fantastic people. So I think career success is very much tied to, you know, how are you channeling your energies in collaboration with others to build something that is lasting in its impact, and which is, you know, making a net positive contribution. And your ability to work with others, whether they're your direct employees or direct reports, or whether they're your clients, or whether they're other stakeholders in an ecosystem of influence, to me, success is defined much more about the success of those relationships today than whatever might be conjured by a particular title.
And I don't know if you are planning a career move right now, but Johan is wondering what would be your ideal next career move that integrates all of your past experiences in terms of organization, positions, responsibility?
Well, I feel very lucky that the role that I'm in right now, which I've relatively recently grown into, is actually, I feel it does integrate all of my past experiences right now. I'm working for Calvert Research and Management, which has a 40-year history in the responsible investment field. So a gold-plated kind of original firm that's been operating in this space since the 1980s. That means that we have built a loyal following and client base, particularly among US retail investors, because not only are we providing investment solutions that generate attractive returns, but we're very authentic in our commitment to a vision of positive change. And we have the track record to back that up. It's not a recent thing for us. You can see it in our the companies that we invest in. You can see it in the way that we speak to those companies and advocate for positive change at those companies, positive change that is good for planet, good for people, but also good for the investors and for the company over the long term. And you can see it in our proxy voting record as well. So the way in which we hold management teams accountable to certain norms of good governance and emerging norms around environmental and social management. So I actually feel like I'm in the perfect spot right now to integrate my, and it's taken a while, you know, to get to this spot, but I'm super excited about the opportunity ahead of us at Calvert and the inflection point that we're at in the capital markets, where I think that there is a lot of attention being paid now to this concept of externalities, like the concept that environmental and social resources or factors or risks were ever externalized from the management of a corporation. I think that's being fundamentally challenged right now. It's been challenged not only by the investment community, but also by regulators. And I think in a world where governments are increasingly hamstrung or appear to be ineffective in the face of global crises, I think even more attention is being spent by the public on corporate leaders to fill a void of authentic moral and ethical leadership as we kind of go into a period of rapid change. So I think this concept of spiritual capital is an interesting one. It's not one that I hear very much in my space. Certainly the concern with ESG greenwashing is there. I don't think that that's necessarily inherent to the field or to the impulse behind the growth of sustainable and responsible investing. It's not inherently there. I think that in many cases, it's actually a mismatch of understanding from the buyer of that fund or the person who invests in that fund or the person who buys the shares of that company, their personal perception of what positive social environmental management or change looks like and what the actual fund claims to do. I think that there's a mismatch often in expectations around what's achievable, what the fund has disclosed that it's doing, and what people think they're buying. So I think a lot of the noise around greenwashing is actually goes back to a lack of understanding of how the data works, like the underlying data that you can get about companies or get from companies about environmental and social metrics. And then what you can then do with that in an investment process at scale. And then frankly, what's even available to you in different asset classes. I think that there's a lot of education that still needs to happen in the market, as well as a lot of standardization of the metrics that's happening. That's a regulator conversation that's very live right now, the standardization of ESG disclosure metrics, which will make all of this stuff easier to communicate and easier for companies to just focus on disclosing. So I guess I understand the greenwashing concern, but I actually think a lot of it is, there's some of it is happening among companies and among investors as, a marketing ploy or maybe disingenuously, but I actually think a lot of it's actually happening because there's a misalignment of expectations.
Joanne was making a comment, you mentioned ESGs, and he said ESG and spiritual capital. Have you been able to find a connection there?
I think that, first of all, I actually have a little bit of an issue with the term capital generally. So I think that the term capital, and I have to face this a lot, human capital, natural capital. And one of the things I really think that we need to be careful about in our discourse is why does everything have to be turned into capital so that we can then actually think about it or deal with it? And is this, and I'm posing it as a question, I don't necessarily have the answer, but is this concept of capital actually reflecting that the concept of capitalism, which is essentially taking resources, extracting profit and returning, giving out less than the owner of that asset can extract, has that become so ingrained in the way we see the world that everything has to be a form of capital so that we can then integrate it into the way we think? So I just want us to pause and think about that, because I'm not sure that we should be thinking about human beings as a source of capital. But with all of that said, certainly, if we think about the idea of, I guess, resources, or the idea that there is a source of value, there are elements that provide a source of value, and that source of value can be turned into another source of value for someone else, right? It can be transformed, it can be distributed. So certainly I think the idea of spiritual resources, I think there is a lot of kind of alternative language used for what I think is underlying that is a spiritual impulse or a spiritual concept, like retention and motivation of employees and creating a meaningful workplace for employees. And I see a lot of discussion around from management teams in my own experience, and then also in business discourse about how do we keep people? How do we keep people engage with their communities? How do we create, what is the social purpose of a corporation? So this concept of stakeholder capitalism, to me, is an attempt to translate what I think is fundamentally a spiritual principle of the interconnectedness of all things and the interdependence of all things, all forms of life and all of these resources. That is a way of trying to translate that idea of interconnectedness into a concept that I think in a capitalist system we can start to engage with and interact with. So I don't see this term spirituality or spiritual capital being used very much, but I see a lot of proxy concepts emerging right now, which I think is very exciting. I think we're in a very fertile time where the kind of very transactional or extractive forms of entities relating to one another, I think, is being questioned at pretty deep levels.
Emily, you're visibly very happy with where you are now. I've said it a few times. What is your greatest challenge now? What is it that worries you actually about the way things are done around you?
Oh, that is such a good question. So I'm happy today, Mahmood. There are other days when it's certainly very challenging. I worry about, I will admit to this, I have quite a bit of climate depression right now. So I am feeling like I've been working really hard for 11 years in this field. And I've seen a lot of incredible movement and progress faster than I could have imagined in terms of the amount of money that's now being applied to climate problems, the amount of kind of commitments being made by really large organizations, both in the investment industry and in, among corporates, that you would have never imagined even 2 or 3 years ago, like the number of companies that have made ambitious carbon reduction or greenhouse gas reduction targets, or they've committed to aligning their business with net zero. And there's a whole kind of academic community and scientific community around figuring out what are the metrics and how do you measure that and what are the scenarios, blah, 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 blah. But I do feel like it's still not happening fast enough to avert a lot of troubles for humanity in the post-2030 era. And that's very much within sight for all of us from where we stand today. And it is a critical decade. And I do worry that while I believe that every organization has its role to play, that we're still not able to coordinate fast enough to avert some of the worst impacts. So I'm sorry if I don't have a very positive message around that right now, but it is actually something that I'm worried about. And that's why forums like this are so important, because I think trying to infuse the culture and of business and to influence thought among business leaders to be more integrated, to be looking at these long-term systemic risks, to be figuring out how we can collaborate together more effectively is so important.
Yeah, is your organization, Emily, set up, as I noted in my commentary, one, Lawrence Miller's book, Spiritual Enterprise, there's a statement of, we don't rise to the level of our goals, we fall to the level of our systems. Mm-hmm. So our systems right now that are in play are extraction-based pretty much across the globe. The org charts of that pyramid structure that's top-down do not build itself for consultation. Yes. Whereas the concentric circles that we build in our own communities, that's where I'm finding is the challenge, is uprooting that org chart system and getting the person who might be head of a company to be that channel, to be the flow point, and not necessarily the sole decision maker. Are you seeing different pressures in the industry to force different changes in organization charts?
I'm absolutely seeing pressure on organizational cultures. I don't think that I haven't seen really radical changes in org charts as such. For the most part, but I would say that I think organizational culture is shifting to be much more consensus-driven, consultative. It just has to be, because I think COVID is really the experience, if you're a knowledge worker, of being at home for the last 2 years and not being able to have go into an office where all of the office related hierarchies kind of get reinforced. I think it's been a great equalizing force for a lot of organizational cultures. I think it's also been really hard to build human relationships with, you know, employee turnover. So I think culture is under pressure from a lot of different forces, technological opportunities for digital nomads. You know, it's more possible now to start your own business and to thrive off that than ever before. I think also people are really reevaluating what a meaningful life looks like in the context of COVID and the suffering that's facing us collectively as humanity, and that's also driving different choices. So I think as a result, to the extent that organizational culture needs to respond so that people feel listened to, heard, people of diverse backgrounds, there's a lot of interest in making sure that teams are diverse, either not just kind of visually diverse, but also cognitively diverse. And there's a lot of interest in how do we create information sharing or decision-making models that really tap into the best talents of everyone. I think some of the forces that operate against a more consultative, you know, circular form of organization is, you know, the need to perform and deliver tangible financial results still on a fairly short quarterly timeframe for larger public companies. And so I think it takes a long time to build that consultative culture and for it to be effective. And therefore, you kind of never, I think it's easy to see how organizations never really get around to it because they're under constant pressure to perform. But I would really recommend the work of Layli Miller Muro from the Tahoe Justice Center, because she's just stepped down as the from working for Tahoe full time, but she has developed a lot of quite sophisticated thinking about how to run an organization across different sites. In her case, it was national. They had large operations in different locations. How to run it in a way where you've got the appropriate types of decisions being consulted on at the appropriate level at the appropriate time.
Yes, I'm trying to figure out how to minimize the effect of mononumerosis. One of the things that made it appealing to a lot of management was the ability to put things in financial terms. So it took all this stuff and put dollars on it. And then, of course, that's the first thing that happened. The second thing that happened is that people said, oh, so that's the game we're playing now. And they figured out how to game that system. And so I'm just wondering, is this idea, your Emily, you mentioned capitalism and tagging all kinds of different descriptors, different types of capitalism, is that similar, or could it go down a similar path? And how can we help to cause that to be more enlightened and be guided more by spiritual principles, like some of the chat comments that we've had?
I think that's such an insightful comment. Thanks, Phil. That is one of the challenges I worry about also, is once you've called it capital, then you can price it. And there's a lot of focus on figuring out, well, what's the true price of just carbon? You know, that is still a challenge today. But then what's the true price of, you know, this level of turnover to the organization, or all these different things? And some of the adverse in outcomes or unintended outcomes, I would say, of pricing things is that they can then just be written off as a cost. And so the outcome may be, if the subject of analysis is the individual company and you're looking at the individual company's financial statements, and you can say, well, here's a cost, I'm willing to just write that cost off, well, that's just a cost of doing business. If that can very easily happen if you don't have a broader framework goal setting for humanity. So one of the things that I think is really powerful about the Paris Agreement is that it has, for the first time really, established this is the global carbon budget we have. You know, there's a science that underpins the temperature rise commitment or goal of the Paris Agreement. The science is basically that there's X amount of greenhouse gas parts per million in the atmosphere today, and we need to stop it from getting this high in order to avoid catastrophic climate change. And so that essentially, that gives you a number. And that number, and it's a collective number for all of the world. It's not just a number for that an individual company. And that gives you a number that you can then break down to a country allocation and an industry allocation. You can get down to that. What is the alignment of this company with a projected temperature rise? Now, the science is still very imperfect. And I think in some ways it can be an imperfect, it can be a little bit of a diversion to try to get too scientific about this amount of temperature rise is associated with this amount of carbon emissions, and that means this carbon target for this company. Because we know with climate change that once you have some of these, effects that I forget the term for them right now, it's on the tip of my tongue, tipping points. Once you hit certain tipping points, the system becomes unstable. You don't know how it's going to react. But the point is that I think it's given humanity a beacon. It's given everyone a goal to say, okay, we need to collectively work together to bring the temperature down. And I think some of the work that's being done that I know Arthur Dahl is leading, they're coming out of the last conference of the parties the climate conference of the parties at Glasgow, is focused on how do we come up with a global system of accounting around some of these systems. And I think that kind of work is really important to happen in parallel with the bottom up. Here's one company, here's their kind of list of disclosures, their individual metrics. we as investors take those metrics, put it in the system, we might start to build models around that, which is the bottom-up work. I think these two things need to meet, top-down and bottom-up.
Emily, just a question mine itself, maybe it's a little bit off-center, but it's about young people and the next coming 20 to 30 years. Because as you know, I'm sure, we're looking at existential crisis in many different fields coming in the 20, 30 years. About young children, how do we look at them? Because sometimes I think we should be telling them that the transformation is needed, and they need to think of life a little bit different than the life, for example, that I lived in the last 50 years around the world. Have you thought much about that?
I do think about it. I think about it in relation to my nephew and my niece, who are 5 and 1.5 respectively. And I think about what the world's going to look like in 2030 and in 2050 and beyond, and they'll be alive. And what are they really inheriting? And I don't know if I have a great answer for you, Gary, because I don't think anyone has a crystal ball, but I do think that everything we can do to raise the next generation of individuals who understand the interconnectedness of all things, who are extremely not only intellectually capable and tapping into all of the intellectual capacities that we don't normally tap into given our current education system, but not only their intellectual capacities, but also their emotional and spiritual capacities so that they can be fully, truly integrated human beings. I see the future as really needing people who are fully integrated in themselves. And I think that is actually still quite a profound and challenging concept. I don't actually see that very much around me, like people who, you know, are fully integrated in terms of their emotional, their EQ, as well as their IQ. And maybe you can add SQ to that as well, spiritual quotient as well, as because I just don't see how we're going to need a lot of creativity to solve mass migrations, border issues, kind of the role of technology in human identity. Like we have so many kind of issues coming at us that need creative solutions and not the solutions from the past. So it's a very general answer. I haven't thought about it in a lot of detail, to be honest, because I don't know what the next 30 years will hold, but I would say that I'm worried. trying to do whatever I can to, at least on a personal level, be able to say to my niece and nephew, well, I really tried. And I really tried in the systems that were available, that I was operating in, and the tools that were available to me to give you something to work with here. But
Thank you.
Thank you, Emily. Before we wrap up, the time is flying and so many interesting questions still coming through. I wonder if you have any question for the audience before we wrap up.
But my question is just, you know, what actions are people taking? We've talked about kind of dire crises facing the world, and how I'm interested to hear from this group, what actions are you taking, whether it's through your work or through other fields of endeavor, to respond to that in the way that, and how have you felt, how have you thought through those choices? And formulated those actions as meaningful for you?
Yeah, actually just stepped into a new, my first career here in Europe, where I'm originally from Shanghai, China, and studying here in the new continent. well, I actually it's been a challenge and also fascinating experience, I would say, in the last couple of years here, that what you think that prompts one to step into change, into the unknown, instead of living in a state of comfort or establishment or established life, and what actually you view as a source of change for a person and towards a person who will probably avoid change and prefer to live in a very kind of static mindset. And actually, what do you think that's the tipping point or prompts one to embrace change?
Oh, Nan, it's such a deep question. I wish I knew the answer to that. I feel I don't have many answers to many of the questions today. But I mean, if I just reflect on my own life, I would say what I felt a deep impatience with the state of the world. and wanted to, you know, and there was maybe a sense of adventure as well in terms of moving into a situation where I really didn't have much support or really any contacts when I moved to China, Beijing. But it was really much motivated by this orientation towards the future. So I had a very high conviction that China was going to be the most important kind of cultural, political, economic influence on the world in the 21st century. I found that really fascinating. I also found China to be a very misunderstood element. I had the opportunity to study Chinese history, 20th century history, which is amazing, like so interesting and fascinating. And I just thought, I want to go there and just know what that's all about. So there was an element of, I guess, just conviction that this was going to be important. I didn't know what it was going to look like. But there was an element of faith that I think people who are change oriented have an aspect of faith that if you take one step forward, the next step will become clear, especially if you take that step with the right intentions and with a pure motive. And it's a form of courage. Maybe it's a form of, change orientation. But I think, I suppose I'm describing behaviors more than the reasons why. But in my own life, that's been a big motivator. Like, what's next? Just like I'm just interested in what's next. I'm interested in what the world's going to look like. And I want to know what my role is in that. So, yeah, I don't know if that's a great answer for you, Nan, but...
Yeah, I actually see you as also explorer and actually have also the source of strength and light inside, which actually prompts you to move forward into the darkness or the unknown, which I find it actually must coming down probably from your childhood or your upbringings and how actually you were raised up and gives you such kind of strength.
Definitely. Yeah, I think encouraging people who are trying something new, doing something different or against the grain, just experimenting. I think that's it's an underutilized resource or an underutilized source of capital, encouragement capital. Because I think definitely, I don't think I would have been able to do this if I didn't have that inner sense of calm or an inner sense of that things would be okay in the long run. And it does give you some, I guess, resources to take risks, which I think is part of a change orientation.
Thank you, Emily, for sharing. But I would like to conclude asking you practically, how do you infuse those thoughts to your peers, to your colleagues, to your team? Are you able to influence them? And how do you practically do that on a day-to-day basis? And how do you manage to keep them engaged socially and spiritually, and to make them believe in something that goes beyond profits per se?
Yeah, I think storytelling is really important. Like celebrating wins, helping people feel like they're part of something bigger than themselves. Fostering that collaborative culture where your purpose at work is not only your own kind of success, whether that's measured through compensation or title, but it's about the broader goals of the organization. And that's why I think aligning yourself with an organization where you can really get behind the goals and the kind of ethos of that organization, which is partly its history, partly its leadership, partly what it publicly says, what's the public narrative of that organization. I think that's really important because you want to be able to people to be able to easily plug into something they can.
Hope these insights from EBBF and its ethical people building the future have offered you new insights for meaningful action in your workplace. More information at ebbf.org.